Right, I'd like to start on time if possible. I know it's a lovely sunny day and everybody's excited, but we've got some business to attend to. We've got three presentations of 20 minutes plus 5 minutes discussion as per normal. And the first person that I'd like to introduce is Eleanor Armstrong Perlman, who has an MA in Philosophy of Mind, Tavistock qualification in psychoanalytic psychotherapy and family therapy, and is former chair of psychoanalytic psychotherapy training and former theoretical concepts editor of the British Journal of Psychotherapy. And Eleanor's going to be talking about The Zealots and the Blind, Sexual Abuse Scandals from Freud to Fairbairn.
Okay. Excuse me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, this is no PowerPoint, because I don't belong to that generation. I'd have to be born again to do PowerPoint. And the other thing is, I haven't used a mic before, so I've given up total responsibility to Ivan, but if you shout.
In good hands.
Okay, thank you. I need to be somebody else. Anyway, there's part of my title which is missing. It's The Zealots and the Blind, Accused, Assumed Guilty, Sexual Abuse Scandals from Freud to Fairbairn. Okay, and I'm reading it. The genesis of this paper was a response to the controversy and passion aroused by the allegations of incestuous child abuse in Cleveland, 1987. It is now redrafted in the light of the furore raised by the exposure of the long-term denial of the allegations against Jimmy Savile. The revelations gave rise to a confusional state in the BBC, and the Newsnight programme led to false allegations running wild about Lord McAlpin. David Lee in The Guardian quoted a Newsnight investigator, quote, "There's a common thread running through the failure of Newsnight to run the investigation into real sex abuse by Jimmy Savile, and its insistence in running the false investigation into the non-existent sex abuse by McAlpin. In each case, the executives did not look at the actual evidence. The common thread is this oscillation between blindness and excessive zeal. Historically, voices of the victims have been ignored or dismissed as products of hysterical fantasy or motivated by financial gain. In a later investigation, Dame Janet Smith wrote, the staff, that's at the BBC, turned a blind eye. The initial blindness denied the sexual and abusive features of persons and institutions in loco parentis. The blind eye is a form of seeing but not seeing. When the voices of the abused are overwhelming, however, the preservation of the benign idealized image of the institution is threatened by the exposure of this seeming blindness. When the United Nations report exposed the tainted legacy of the Catholic Church's in-house investigations into abuse allegation, the illusion of benign attachment figures for those in need of solace was compromised. The Church protected the perpetrators by moving them to other parishes, thus endangering further victims. There is, however, with the accession of Pope Francis, in Fairbairnian terminology, hope is restored. This can be viewed as a transference of the idealized, acceptable object that restores trust and hope. Both Alice Miller and Geoffrey Masson claimed that psychoanalytic theory has been blind to the actual prevalence and etiological significance of seduction. The repudiation of childhood innocence led to an idealization of the parent. Freud wrote to Fliess on 7 September 1887, "Surely such widespread perversions against children are not very probable." Freud developed the theory of infantile sexuality in 1906, abandoning his earlier stance developed in The Etiology of Hysteria, 1896. Now the sexualized imagery of the hysteric was seen as a manifestation of unconscious, infantile, sexual, and aggressive drives and their derivatives. Though Freud never denied that there was real-life seduction, he must have been aware of the large numbers of child prostitutes in Vienna. Josephine Mutzenbacher, or The History of a Viennese Whore, as told by herself, was published in Vienna in 1906. The plot, which amounts to an extended description of the sexual activity exhibited by the heroine all before reaching the age of 13. The working-class child, after an early seduction, was seen as the seductress, a common feature of paedophiliac literature. Frenkse emphasized the child's need for tenderness and touch and the adult's need for sexual gratification. Actual seduction was seen as the expression of hostility in the seducer. The child, a helpless victim, cannot afford to see or to register either the event or the hostility. In effect, he resurrected Freud's early arguments in the etiology of hysteria. This theory of dissociation and repression further complicates the relationship between fantasy and reality. The denial of intolerable reality leads to fantasy, just as fantasy distorts reality. The hold on reality is loosened, but for Frenzy, the dissociated part, however, lives on, hidden, endeavoring to make itself felt, without finding any outlet except in neurotic symptoms. For Fairbairn, I'm not reading too fast, am I? Okay. For Fairbairn, it is not actual memories that are necessarily repressed, but intolerably persecuted cutery and exciting relationships with bad objects. The danger is not just the recognition of sexual abuse per se, but that it is a concrete example of parental hostility. Given that the experience of an abusive parent is beyond the child's capacity to tolerate, denial of that reality and the consequent repression of fear, need, and rage is essential. John Bowlby in Conversation said that no child under 9 could tolerate the fact that his parents do not love him. The hold on reality is weakened. Dissociation is achieved by banishing the whole object representation to the inner world. The unacceptable, exciting, and rejective features are shorn, leaving an acceptable core to be transferred to the external object. This leads to separate constellations of self and other. The deadly allure of the siren's song, drawing men to crash on the rocks, I've skipped the phrase of the mother's unresponsiveness, is not only split off, but actively repressed. Actual sexual abuse can be repressed. But if the burden of the badness becomes too intolerable to maintain, it may be transferred back to the object from which it came. To do so may provide relief from the depressive burden of being bad, but this realization may destroy all hope of a loving relationship with a loving parent. Intolerably bad relationships with intolerably bad objects may erupt. There is a risk of despair, overwhelming rage, and aggression. Defensive strategies are necessary if these relationships, reactivated by triggers in the present, clamor for an outlet. Loss of faith in the goodness of goodness can render the world untrustworthy, leading to a quasi-psychotic confusional state. In some of the black paintings of Goya and Rouault, judges are persecutors. You know, they're caricatures of evil figures. When these seemingly benevolent figures are exposed or supposed as or colluding with paedophiles, there's a danger of contagion. Suspicion prevails. For Fairbairn, psychosis is the overwhelming of external reality by internal reality. In neurosis, there is an interplay. I remember a conversation with a friend on the point of a psychotic breakdown after his partner had left him around the time of the war on Iraq. Was Saddam Hussein the new messiah? He needed readmission to escape from this intolerable confusion. In his first schizophrenic breakdown, aged 18, he had the delusion that he had impregnated his evangelical mother. Years later, on separating from her to live with his partner, he had told her to smile at your own man or read your Bible. Eventually, as a devout Catholic attending daily Mass, he found refuge with a Heavenly Father, a total repudiation of the faith of his mother. He remained celibate, cynical about later approaches by women, seeing them as financially motivated. How do we cope when the interplay aroused by internal triggers resonates with our own inner demons? As therapists, how do we stay open to both possibilities of fantasy and abuse? Neutrality is rendered difficult as the facts in cases of sexual abuse vary greatly in their capacity for empirical corroboration. Evidence is based on interpretations of signs, gestures, and recollections from the past. There is first the interpretation of the purported victim, and then the interpretation made by the investigator. There is a need to guard against a collective hysteria when the established order is under threat. The fear of personal and social dissolution can be contained by polarizing the world into a battle between good and bad. Ambivalence is resolved by the creation of a good and a bad object, leading to a Manichaean bipolar world of warring forces. It can also be dangerous to protest against the hysteria of the zealous masses, as conscientious objectors have discovered. There is a need for a demon to safely persecute so the self can protect an idealized relationship with an idealized object. Demonization provides a safety valve which preserves a sanitized image of an acceptable relationship with an benevolent other. The testimony of the child can resonate with and threaten the repressed ambivalence of the adult. The adult was once a child, and all of us, have had to develop defensive strategies to cope with childhood trauma. But I want to argue that's a matter of degree. It's a degree of frustration, thank God. This can then cloud the therapist's response to the material of the patient. To disentangle fantasy from reality, the professional needs to be aware not only of their own counter-transference, but their own defensive strategies. The badness can become externalized, and the alleged perpetrator becomes evil. An internal reality can take precedence over external reality as normal conditions of evidence-seeking are dropped. Culpability is incontrovertible, and the protestations of innocence are taken as resistance to the truth. The abusive, quote, parent's only route to redemption is confession and acceptance of the consequences. They become pariahs stripped of their civil rights. Witch hunts with dawn raids may commence, or attacks by vigilante groups, all in the name of rescuing the child. Monstrous behavior can become justified in the cause of saving the child from the monster parent. As Dr. Bessel van der Kolk states, he's a trauma guy, careful attention needs to be paid to preventing false accusations of abuse. Being accused of such a heinous crime constitutes a traumatic experience with immeasurable consequences. The zealot can rush to the rescue, saving the child from the maligned, unnatural, abusive parents, thus giving safe vent to the infantile sadism. There is danger of a messianic omnipotence in which both the repressed sadistic wishes and the demands of the ego ideal attain simultaneous satisfaction. That's a quote from Fairbairn. Case. One young man I worked with sought therapy on account of the non-consummation of his marriage. He was not of European origin. Exploring his history, there was evidence of early abandonment. he was an incubator baby, an unexpected, an unwanted twin. His memories were of continuous maternal deprivation, interspersed with beatings and intrusive control, but no evidence that the abuse was ever sexual. His father had been passive and had failed to protect him, although domestic servants sometimes intervened. Previous to his original therapy with a born-again Christian therapist, he had been troubled by a perverse, devouring, sexualized fantasies concerning women. He'd never had a girlfriend. His therapist became an idealized mother. They used to sing and play music together. I had the impression that therapy had saved him from potential psychosis. There was no recollections of any sexual abuse. The idea had come from his therapist. Initially, he was both disgusted and shocked. 3 days later, he decided it must be true, gave coherence to his extreme ambivalence towards his mother. The fantasy was that his mother had licked him all over. His accusations led to severe family disruption and counter accusations that he had been brainwashed by his therapist. He broke with his family and married his therapist, a woman 20 years older than him, and came to England. Though sharing the same bed, the marriage was never consummated. He became highly conscious of the fact that he had related to his wife as a surrogate mother. For this he was grateful, but he needed to individuate yet again. He returned to his country of origin and also ended the therapy without his therapist's wife. I took the position of therapeutic neutrality. I respected his narrative as a construction that gave him coherence. Sexual abuse had been taken by his therapist to be the pathogenic agent. Memories and reality-based evidence offer no corroboration. He had mirrored the realities of his early therapy. And the both sides just go on to say there's a need to investigate such allegations carefully. At Cleveland, children were moved from their parents to a hospital ward. One of the examination procedures used as conclusive proof was anal dilation, which it isn't, but it's actually abusive, I think. Cases involving 96 of the 121 children were dismissed by the courts. Such rush to action leaves a trail of devastation. Some children experience symptoms of sleep disorder, acute separation anxiety, conduct disorders, and impoverished educational achievement. Symptoms indicative of PTSD. And the other thing is, it goes on a bit, what I say in the end, we know that deprivation in the Fermanagh model can lead to eroticized fantasy fueled by need. And I go on to say that psychoanalytic theory must pay attention to both poles. So in some sense, I'm trying to use Fairbairn's ideas to make sense of how people totally ignore certain, can't see the violence, and later go on too far. And so I'm saying actual trauma at the hands of a parent does affect the structure of the inner world, but fantasy also exists and distorts. And the flurry of accusation and counter-accusation, unfortunately, it distracts attention from the predicament of the child. I've managed to do it in time. Yeah, I skipped lots. Sorry. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that very important and timely. Can you hear me? Yes, timely paper. Have we got any comments or questions?
Seamus Pryor, University of Edinburgh. Thank you, Eleanor. I think this is one of the main difficulties, dilemmas, areas of doubt and confusion of our time, as we've seen with all the high-profile media court cases. I wonder where you stand on the recent exonerations of famous media figures who've been accused by teenage girls of sexual abuse and have been found not guilty. That's happened several times in the last year.
Look, I haven't got a clue. You know what I mean? There's a need for investigation. Some of them, it sounds real. Do you know what I mean? I think that has to go for the courts. You know, it's you have to go for a criteria of evidence. Because, there's one case of a pediatrician who was murdered by people thinking being a pediatrician meant pedophile. And, you know, there's that, I'm concerned about the excitement you can get. And the bit of the paper I couldn't use was how I liked best was James I and VI's persecuted witches. And he was abandoned by his mother for the father who married the man who did murder his father. So I'm saying he's Oedipus and Hamlet combined, with no Gertrude and Claudius to hate. And he's coming back from his marriage. There was a storm, and he began to believe in witches. Well, you know, I know people whose husbands have had schizophrenic breakdowns on getting married. You know, they can't cope. So I was thinking in some ways he actually began to investigate women under torture. And you know what I mean? And that was in the context of Malleus Maleficarum, the disintegration of the social order with Catholicism, and then you got Catholics hating Catholics, Protestants hating Protestants, and 40,000-60,000 people were burned as witches. Yes, you know, so I'm interested in Fairbairn and apply to social conditions.
Anybody else want to comment or question?
Yes. Joe Schwartz from the Bowlby Center. I'm a little concerned with what seems to be equal or perhaps even more weight towards the overzealousness rather than the blind eye. And it makes me extremely uneasy because it's extremely hard for victims to get their voices heard. And when you emphasize the overzealousness, which can be a very difficult clinical problem, but in the social scene, I really kind of support, you know, these people do seem to be being let off, and I wonder kind of what your view is about the difficulties here of actually identifying the perpetrators. And it reminds me of the difficulties women have had about making charges of rape, because all the man has to do is say, she led me on, and he's off. Right, so what do you reckon?
I actually reckon, you know, it's very difficult. I actually am more interested because I know somebody who was children were taken into care and then the case was closed and it was based on hysteria. And I know people who've had their children taken into care on, you know what I mean? There's a rush to action and casualty and it hasn't been investigated and the children and the parents are traumatized. So I'm more interested in So in some sense, I've been more interested with the children bit than the latter. You know, and I think, you know, I think it always needs to be investigated, of course.
But look what happened with Baby P.
Yeah, well, I'm saying that's blind, not, that was blindness.
Well, look, I think, Joe, the problem is that what we have is an extremely complex intermix of this, where there has been blindness to actual abuse. No question about it. It's certainly happened in the church, but the church doesn't have a monopoly on these things. And then there is a hysterical overrush, and they are both problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really, in a way, I thought the false memory movement became a bigger problem than abuse for some time, and now it's back to a point where we're just, in any case, you don't know, but there are so many cases, for instance, of rather erratic spouses accusing their partners of abuse really as a conscious or unconscious ploy to get custody, for instance. And I think you really have to be careful. There are guidelines for getting a pretty good first approximation that the press has no interest in. But we need to have an interest in that. And there are publications. Richard Gardner has a very long and good book, actually, on false accusations of abuse, which is an equal problem in our mind. Who knows what the percentages are? But in our mind, we really have to be open to weighing these very complicated cases where it's usually two difficult people having at each other.
Can I come in with something there? I came just knowing people and being this world of sick because of widows, single-parent mothers. I came across a case of one friend who told me how she'd gone to social services about thinking her child, her ex-partner had abused her son. She had no evidence for it. Social services investigated absolutely thoroughly and gave the father more custody. And he's actually a brilliant father. And I actually met her father in real life. I have never met a colder fish. You know what I mean? He was really cold. So I think she was, anything sexualizing him, later on she dropped it. But she, you know, and I commented to her, God, your father, he was so unhelpful, it was horrible. You know, we were all single parents with kids. And she said, you think he's cold? My mother was worse. You know, and she'd had multiple separations, you know, because the father was in diplomatic service. And I think she wasn't even being malicious.
Okay, thank you very much, Eleanor.
Okay, thanks.
Our next presenter is Carlos Rodriguez Sutil, PhD, president of the Relational Psychotherapy Institute, member of the board of the IARPP in Spain, published more than 80 articles and books, and is in private practice in Madrid, presumably.
Yes.
In Madrid.
I tried.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for your invitation. I'm going to read the presentation. This is not my presentation. Sorry. Ferbin's contributions to understanding of personality disorders.
Go ahead.
With Ferbin, the clinical emphasis shifts from the horizontal repression of drives to the vertical splitting of internal objects and their related egos. In any event, his theory is focused on early psychic organizations previous to the Oedipal phase and on the basic endopsychic structure. Oedipus is merely the last layer in the psychic formation. In the classical Greek myth, Oedipus began his life by being abandoned on a mountain by his parents, who led him there to die from exposure, completely deprived of maternal care at an age of a great dependency. Castration anxiety becomes pale in comparison to the role played by this early separation anxiety. Schizoid pathology derives from a fixation in the early oral stage in comparative and preambivalent, while manic depressive states derive from the late oral stage ambivalent, with teething and the subsequent potential to bite. The preambivalent child believes that his love is rejected when he feels frustrated by his mother, which results in a feeling of futility, deeper and more absolute than melancholic despair. Ferbin's work with schizoid patients allowed him to define three main features: omnipotence, isolation, and detachment, and preoccupation with internal life. These attitudes and phenomena are present to a greater or lesser degree in a variety of subjects whose need to be loved remains hidden under a mask of detachment and emotional apathy and futility, reaching such a state of inertia that it can often be misdiagnosed as depression. They allow themselves to love and be loved only in the distance, as troubadours and dictators, thus trying to protect at the same time both internal and external objects. To take is equivalent to accumulating bodily contents, and to give is to lose these bodily contents. When they give, they tend to feel impoverished. The child comes to regard his mother as a bad object insofar as she does not seem to love him. Regarding outward expression of his love, his own love as bad, and retaining the love inside himself in order to protect it. The child also keeps his love shut in because he feels that it is too dangerous to release it upon the objects. In short, it is said that the depressive fears destroying the object with his hatred, while the schizoid fears destroying it by his love. The huge need for a good love object overlaps with an equally great fear of interpersonal relationships. In contemporary psychoanalysis, we are used to the distinction between explicit and implicit thought and memory, declarative and procedural, and between ideas and memories that can be consciously retrieved and manipulated and those that are expressed through behavior without conscious awareness. Procedural memory is bodily incorporated and stems in part from early developmental stages. It operates outside of verbal consciousness as well as outside of the dynamic unconscious. That is to say, the repressed and declarative unconscious verbally structure that speaks through the symptoms. It does not seem unreasonable to think that that procedural memory is the basis of personality or character. In patients suffering from regressive conditions, repression having failed, unconscious contents split off into all good and all bad entities. And the psychic structure is dominated by the ambivalence, and it is impossible to reach any form of mourning. When the moral defense is the dominant process, the child keeps on in its adherence to the internal objects and hopes that in the future, the external antilibidinal rejecting object will change and become a loving object. It has been remarked that the masochistic subject may experience a feeling of deep satisfaction and justice by destroying himself or herself, a suitable explanation for some cases of negative therapeutic reaction. The infantile oral dependency upon the object gradually gives way to the mature genital dependency upon the object through a transitional stage. There are four transitional defenses in this stage: paranoid, obsessive, phobic, and hysterical. These defenses, or neurotic styles, are used to avoid the two great psychopathological disasters that threaten the child: schizoid and depressive states. Primary identification is akin to oral incorporation and retention, while differentiation is equivalent to expulsion. Retention and expulsion are mechanisms with which we can differentiate and classify neurotic styles. The triangular situation that underlies the conflict is not constituted by three persons, child, mother, and father, but essentially by the central ego, the libidinal object, and the antilibidinal object. It is in the context of the child's relationships with its maternal environment where differentiation of the endopsychic structure takes place and where repression arises. It is only afterwards that the child is called to cope with the particular difficulties involved in the classic Oedipal situation. The four techniques employed against primitive anxieties can also be understood as four high-range behavioral patterns or personality structures from the viewpoint of object relations with external objects. This is the structure. I also prefer the internal saboteur for me is the best name. This is the schedule, the table of the different techniques. In summary, the obsessive individual retains and tries to dominate both objects, ambivalence. The phobic individual externalizes both objects, trying to escape from the bad one and take refuge in the good one. The paranoid individual externalizes the bad object and attacks it, maintaining the good one inside. And the hysterical individual does the opposite, externalizes the good object and attaches to it, and internalizes the bad object by rejecting it into the interior. Grothstein notes that internalized objects form the mold that will host the schizoid, narcissistic, borderline, and multiple personality disorders, and the general condition of being schizoid. Fairbairn's schizoid personality, Grothstein added, is very similar to the current concept of narcissistic personality disorder, while his account of the schizoid states is very close to the contemporary definition of borderline states. Internal grandiosity and exhibitionism is in schizoid personality overlap with the narcissistic feelings as articulated by Kohut. But if we affirm that Fairbairn's description of schizoid disorders comprises the current general concept of borderline and narcissistic disorders, and is especially appropriate for their comprehension, we are unavoidably led to infer the complementary idea that the theory is not valid for less pathological patients, as some authors have suggested. On the other hand, bearing in mind the distinction between deficit and conflict psychopathology made by Bjørn Kligmo, a Norwegian, which differentiates pre-Oedipal disorders from those mainly Oedipal, we can accept Rinsley's idea that Fairbairn's schizoids are the result of a fundamentally developmental and not regressive pathogenesis, resulting from a very early deficiency of the maternal container. Paul is a young man in his 30s. He works for a multinational company as an electronic technician. Came to see me about his doubts whether or not to marry his partner, who worked in the same company and with whom he had a son. A while after getting married, the patient reported that his wife had a private life of her own. She went out with a group of friends and he was not allowed to join in. She even went on holiday with them regularly. He could be showing the relational style of a moderate borderline personality disorder, emotional lability, mental confusion, free-floating anxiety, and separation anxiety. And he has made more than one suicide attempt disguised as a traffic accident, where at least on one occasion the car was a write-off. When speaking of his mood swings, the cause of which is unknown to him, he remembers that his father, now deceased, had peaks of aggression when he would break things and beat him and his brothers, as well as his mother. In the patient, however, these peaks were resolved through flight and consumption of alcohol. During a bank holiday weekend, he felt very upset because he had a leave from work, but his wife did not, and his son, 7 or 8 years old, went away with a classmate to his parents' country house. He felt badly because he would have liked to be with his child. The son, by contrast, was very happy. The therapist pointed out that his reaction was more childish than his son's, and he agreed. Then he described a situation at a party that he and his wife went to that same weekend. The men decided to play cards, and then the women said they were going to a bingo hall. For that moment onwards, he felt abandoned and stopped enjoying the party. After the women were only away for an hour and a half, he understands that his reaction is inadequate and that it prevents him from enjoying the advantages of being alone at times. He never feels at ease when he's alone. Then he recalls a painful situation as a child, unable to identify the exact age. His mother went to work and left him locked up at home under the care of a neighbor. Abandonment anxiety emerges as the dominant feeling. The central ego appears fragile, but we also observe important deficits in those parental figures that could serve the function of ideal object. Paul's experience of his mother and his relationships with his wife, along with his personal reactions, suggests that his central ego is dominated by the antilibidinal aspects of personality. The antilibidinal ego and the antilibidinal object exert a powerful pressure on the libidinal aspects, thus depriving the patient of the most minimal enjoyment. As we may observe, this relational constellation can't be just directly interpreted. Effective treatment entails increasing self-reflective capacity of the patient, accompanying him in the process of a gradual elaboration and helping him understand that the feelings of frustration that he experienced in his marriage do not arise independently but resulted from past and present environmental circumstances. The antilibidinal object has in part replaced the ideal object. He wants to get closer to an ideal but feels confused about what that may be. He has only learned that it involves renunciation, self-devaluation, and self-destruction in situations of extreme frustration. Conclusion. Fairbairn's description of endopsychic structure hardly applies to pure schizoid and antisocial disorders, including the thick-skinned or malignant narcissistic patient. Endopsychic structure is not valid before the solid constitution of an ego ideal object, just before the completion of the superego or at the depressive position. But not every subject delineates a stable ego ideal to which to aspire to emulate. In my opinion, the fear that one's love is destructive does not originate in the schizoid position, but rather is the result of its optimal evolution. Fear of being destructive is a form of depressive anxiety, since it requires at least some elaboration, however slight, of the feeling of guilt. Futility, on the other hand, is a common feeling of in the reckless destroyer, evidently free of guilt. Perhaps Fairbairn classified as schizoid and Kohut as narcissistic, many individuals now likely to be diagnosed as suffering from a borderline personality. If this is correct, the schizoid, psychopathological, aggressive, and purely narcissistic patterns should be traced back to earlier stages in personality development. By locating moral defense in the schizoid position, it seems that Fairbairn may be failing to include the unconditionally good psychopath. Yes. Maybe he never came across one. Beyond borderline organization, there is the individual who, because of an early lack of empathic support, never displays any form of empathy or guilt. Fairbairn, however, identifies an immoral motivation for the discharge of aggression in schizoid states. Since the pleasure of love is forbidden, the pleasure of hating is allowed, to which enjoyment we can devote ourselves. Given that love involves destructiveness, it seems the best to destroy it through hate in a fashion close to the narcissistic personality individual with antisocial attitudes and the antisocial individual in its most strict sense. However, these subjects become bad not in order to protect their good objects, but in my opinion, to keep all goodness inside themselves. Finally, I want to remark that Fairbairn remains excessively focused on the intrapsychic structure, on an inner wall that ultimately takes precedence, never fully conceiving personality as an open system that continuously influences and is influenced by external experiences. An authentic theory of human relations would affirm that what is introjected is neither images nor objects. What is introjected, or rather learned, are patterns of action or interaction. The objects Fairbairn is talking about are not, strictly speaking, representations. They are unconscious procedural patterns of action, activated in interpersonal emotional relations in a process of dialectical adaptation to the partner's own procedural patterns. Well, I want to show some books that have influenced my intellectual development very greatly. This is the Argentinian translation of his main book I read 30 years ago. For me, was a personal experience. And this is the book I published 4 years ago about the Fairbairn work. And I dare not to recite this poetry, but for me it's a very good end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carlos. you have any questions or comments? Anybody? Yes?
What date was that Argentine translation of psycholytic studies of the personality?
They made this translation in Buenos Aires, and there is no other translation. It's not necessary for us to read it in Argentinian. Spanish is quite good.
What is the date?
The date is the 1970, I don't remember exactly the translation. Do you remember, Vasily? Do you remember the translation?
Anybody else got any comments or questions?
I read it around 1980-82.
I'm interested in the diagram that Fairbairn did of the disposition of good and bad objects in the transitional stages. And I think that's one of the least developed aspects of research into whether or not that that diagram actually holds true in therapeutic and other circumstances. And I'd welcome anybody's sort of comments on that, because it seems to me one of the undeveloped aspects of Fairbairn's theory.
For me, this organization, this table has a lot of technical implications.
Yeah.
But today is not in fashion to speak about technical questions. Right. But
well, perhaps we can change the fashion.
No. Well, David Scharf, you'll hear later this morning that Otto Kernberg thinks while it's too rigid to be absolutely true, it's a very useful clinical approximation of what we see. For instance, the idea that the hysteric feels she doesn't have anything good inside, so she's got to be searching the world to find it. That's a very
schematic.
It's a nice schematic that can help an interpretive line without our trying to reify it into something that is a program for some kind of deprogramming of the hysteric or something like that.
Yeah, I think my point about that is that in an evidence-based world, people do not look at the extent to which that is true in therapeutic encounters where you've thought that somebody is hysterical or phobic or whatever, and whether or not they do dispose of objects in the way that's predicted that they will do. Anybody else got any comments? Ruben?
Estudios psicoanalíticos de la personalidad was traduced. Sorry?
They can't hear you. Just make sure it's on.
Estudios psicoanalíticos de la personalidad was traduced into Spanish in 1952.
1952?
By Jorge Mon.
Anybody else? All right. Yeah?
I'm from Ward Ford Museum.
It was originally published in 1951 or 1952. The same year was translated into Spanish.
Carlos, I was just wondering if you knew Freud's little paper, Libidinal Types. Have you come across this paper?
The Libidinal Types by Freud?
Yeah.
Well, for me, the most important paper by Freud regarding the different personalities is the one article by 1916 about the different types of personality discovered in the analytic investigation
character types in
character types, yeah.
But Libidinal Types is 1930 or 31. And it's where he puts he says he's trying to think about personality structures. Whoa. And he says he's going to assign personalities according to the distribution of libido in the psychic apparatus. So in other words, he creates a kind of model similar to to this thing. So he talks about the obsessional type, the narcissistic type, and what he calls the erotic type, but which would most clearly be the hysterical type. And it's a kind of very interesting where he shows the false idea of separation of structure and energy, because he's putting the two together in this in this paper. And even though it's quite quirky, it's a kind of interesting.
It's only
three and a half pages. A lot of people miss it, but it's a quirky little piece, but worth looking at and thinking, reading between the lines.
I'm sorry, we haven't got time now. I'm going. Thank you very much, Carlos, very much. Again. I'm very pleased now to be able to introduce Valerie Sinnerson, PhD, Director of the Clinic for Dissociative Studies, President of the Institute for Psychotherapy and Disability, poet, writer, child and adult psychotherapist and adult psychoanalyst, former consultant psychotherapist, the Tavistock Clinic and St. George's Hospital, and recently edited Trauma, Dissociation and Multiplicity. I expect lots of people here know her anyway, so I don't probably need to introduce her. And she's going to be talking on abuse, trauma and multiplicity.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
No PowerPoint.
Would you like a bit of light? First of all, I want to thank David Scharf and Graham Clark for bringing together this feast of a book and a conference. We've all had a bit of a multiple experience getting these tasters all through, but the key Fairburnian themes are going right through them. And I have come to Fairburn outside of the internal saboteur and the moral defence. I've come really late to Fairburn, thanks to them. And I'm absolutely shocked at how my clinical work would have been so different had I been introduced to his work in my training earlier. And I'm really grateful to have it now. And I shall be just in a couple of weeks in Copenhagen at the ESTD meeting, the European Society for Trauma and Dissociation, be bringing details of the book, and I'm hoping Joe Schwartz here as editor of the ESTD newsletter will be highlighting the amount that Fairburn spoke about dissociation, which really makes up for the shameful lack of analytic care on this crucial subject. So it's not surprising that, like all pioneers, his work couldn't be adequately accepted at the time he wrote it. Abuse and dissociation are unbearable now, and it's shocking to realize his MD in 1929, as David Scharf brought to our attention yesterday, 1929, it was on dissociation and his work with abused children and adolescents. Whilst many of his theories are relevant to working with extreme trauma, trafficked women, boy soldiers, children and adults with dissociative identity disorder through cult abuse, which are my areas of work, I'm focusing on the key concepts that help me with this client group through three small clinical vignettes to bring in the relational patient and therapist together with the co-constructed reality to look at the moral defense, the meaning of feeling bad, the need for a relational approach, and the excitement and yearning for the bad object. And I have permission, obviously, for these disguised extracts. The moral defense, Mary. Mary, age 10, had Down syndrome and a severe intellectual disability. She had been referred for masturbating in her classroom all the time. In the therapy session, she started masturbating immediately and offering her body to me with a big smile. She called herself Dirty Mary. I used a doll in the room that she called Lucy to explore this further. I said, "Hello, Lucy. We think you're looking rather sad. And we think you might know about the kind of things that make Mary sad." "Really?" asked Mary. "Yes," I said, you ask her." "Lucy, are you dirty?" "Yes," I said in a whispery voice. "I'm Dirty Lucy." Mary lifted up the doll's dress. All smiles gone. "Does your daddy poo and pee on you?" "Yes," I whispered. "It's your Down syndrome," she said conversationally. "That's why he does it." "Is that why Lucy's daddy pees and poos on her?" I asked. "Yes. So if she didn't have Down syndrome, he wouldn't do that." "No, sad, angry Down syndrome mongrel baby girl." "Would you pee and poo on a little girl if you had a little girl with Down syndrome?" "No," she shouted, and looked at me shocked at the power of her response. "I'm going to wash Dirty Lucy," she said, and she took the doll to the sink and gently washed her. Then she burst into tears and threw the doll on the floor. "Now her daddy will die." "Why will he die now?" I asked. "He's got all the dirt back, and Lucy won't have a daddy." I was astounded, as I always am, by the emotional understanding of someone that is supposed to be incapable with a severe disability. I said, "Goodness me, you're so clever, Mary. Is that right for you too? If you were a clean, happy Mary, would something bad happen to your daddy too?" Now that tiny extract has got many issues in it. Children with intellectual disabilities have feelings and fantasies about their condition and its origins, and are more vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. But they also have the capacity for the deepest emotional understanding. As Fairbairn would say, to see herself as bad and dirty is less terrible for Mary than to see her needed father as bad. This allows her to be in control of having Down syndrome, the awful randomness of nature. And in all my clinical work, the most entrenched long-term problem that often can never be sorted after 20 years of therapy is that imprinted sense of badness. 2. Angela. There's 3 clinical examples. Angela, aged 36, faced me defiantly with a bruised face from her husband's attention. "No way could she lie down on a couch. My beautiful analytic couch has not been used once. I bought it for myself when I qualified. All my patients have to look at me. They couldn't lie down. That would hurt more of their bodies. They couldn't have me sitting behind them. They're scanning my face, waiting for the hate to show and waiting for me to get up to kill them." So I told her about the work I'd just discovered at Newcastle University, where Dr. John Lazarus has done some brilliant research on why antelopes in Africa feed in front of their main predator, the lion. This is so beautifully Fairbairnian, but she knew what the answer was immediately. "I know the answer to that," she laughed. "It's the safest place, isn't it?" And I nodded. She said, "Like when my father was asleep, drunk in front of me, I knew I was safe, really safe. I could take some food from the fridge, take his fags. But if I ran out of the house to get help, I could run into a whole gang of drunk perverts. And knowing my luck, I would." I said, "You've got it. And that's animal research, and we're all animals, so it's only natural you go back to him. But of course she was sure it was because of her badness. When 2 years later she tried again to leave her husband, I reminded her, Angela, it's having to orphan yourself. What an awful predicament you've been landed with. And I said, as I often say to such patients, just imagine if you were to say to a happily married person with loving parents and children, you pathetic codependent human, you've gone and repeated just what your parents have done. They're loving, you've gone and done exactly the same. If you don't leave your partner and home immediately, I'll never talk to you again. And humour was a crucial part of the therapeutic relationship in which the worst realities could be expressed. And Fairbairn's early awareness of the real relationship has been so precious here. Depending on age and understanding, I've often found it helpful to take an educational line as well and say, do you know, thanks to your hard work, you've got to the hardest point that you'll ever get to in therapy, and we may never get to the end of this. It can take a lifetime. It's this I am bad. As a baby, you can't help feeling that whatever the adults do is due to you. A baby doesn't have theory of mind. A little one can't conceive of the difficult perversions, pains and complexities of adult life. Then add on abuse, and to survive, you have to feel your caretaker's good. Then the next time you get raped, you can say, I wasn't good enough. Next time I'll do better. Then when you're raped again, I wasn't good enough. So it gives you hope. But then when things get really bad, the grown-ups say, yes, you are bad. That's why I did it. And to top it all, society says, what a horrible thing to say about your lovely parents, and you're a liar. You've got a fictitious disorder. You're attention-seeking. Final example, ritual abuse and dissociative identity disorder, closed systems. Since 1990, I've been working with children and adults who've experienced spiritual or ritual abuse. They have a disorganized attachment, and for many of them, this leads to dissociative identity disorder. They have higher suicidal ideation than any other group. The Fairbairnian explanation for their myriad suicide attempts is crucial here. Dying as a good person is easier than living as a perpetrator. The guilt is unbearable. Text message, and when we are working with dissociative identity disorder, we are getting text messages, emails from myriad personalities right through the week. Text message from Beatrice, age 26, the main personality. I'm sorry, I can't carry on like this. I'm going to kill myself tonight. It's a really hard time for you, I text back. Please forgive me. I want to try, but I can't live with it. I'm not surprised. If you didn't want to die, I would worry there was something wrong with you. You know why I have to do it, don't you? I know I think something of why you have to do it, and I'm sure I'd feel the same. It's, please, you, help me write it. And I wrote, it's not what they did to you, is it? No. It's not the torture you've gone through, the terror, although that would be enough to make most luckier people want to top themselves. Yes. It's what they made you do. Yes. But I did it. You did. And it's no good me saying you were forced to under threat of death. No. I still did it. If I was a good person, I would be dead. You know, one of the worst things I think they did to you was to make you feel that being alive was a perversion. No message, 5-minute gap. Then another personality who texts in italics to differentiate herself, her own style. Fuck you, upsetting her just when she's finally ready to top herself. Pathetic, whinging drama queen. Ooh, I can't bear it. Ooh, it hurts. Just die. I said she needs help from you, Beverly, to stay alive. You fucking lazy professionals, you can't help yourself, you want me to do it. Don't even know what you're dealing with. Call her by all the wrong diagnoses and don't dare know what she's gone through. My family know. They know all of it. You lot don't. And then you call me by her name. I haven't. Oh, one of OK. The health service pays you now, so you should get something right. My family wouldn't stand for this shoddiness. And of course you can hear the tie to family, to bad objects there, and the rage that can go against professionals for any misattunement, but not against the family. 2 years later, after Beverly carried on telling me how useless, appalling I was, writing on the internet, on all her groups, what a terrible therapist she went to. We get shamed in all sorts of ways in this work. I actually said in one session when she was there, Beverly, why are you coming to see me when I am failing you in so many ways? And she said, after all the years I've spent training you. And they have. And in 1954, Fairbairn on the nature of hysterical states, her Freudian slip, which it was historical, again reasserted the fundamental importance of dissociation and the need for that split for survival. And Finnegan and Clark are amongst a very small number who've explored resistances that derive from the maintenance of ties to bad objects and the wish to preserve the inner world as a closed system. And of course there is such a wish. And boy, oh boy, with what people have gone through, we're privileged to be allowed to enter the tiny chinks they allow us. But many thanks to Fairbairn, we can thank at any level the spirit of somebody carrying on and the extra strength that gives all of us for our work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Valerie, for an extremely moving talk. Anybody got anything to say? Yes, Jonathan.
Jonathan Sklar. Very, thank you for an extraordinary short paper. I want to pick up something about the empirical sense of badness that is running through and connect it with what Eleanor was talking about earlier this morning. I want to go back to Ferenczi, because one thing that he wrote in the 1933 paper Confusion of Tongues was not only was the child abused, but the abusing adult would then project into the child all the guilt. I have done this because you have made me. And I think it's that twist which is profound, because one can argue, well, what is traumatic? I mean, is it the grown-up fucking the child, or actually is it the mind that gets totally fucked up with that projection? And that it's that that's so difficult to remove. Thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, Confusion of Tongues is one of my sort of desert island seminal papers as well. And with Mary, we could see her fear that her father would die. And she was the example, since her father actually touched her at all, unlike her neglectful, depressed mother at having a disabled child, that for her it wasn't the actual physical act, it was the knowledge that she was keeping him alive, she was stopping him committing suicide, murder, or a psychotic breakdown, but she'd taken his badness, and if she got rid of it, would he manage? And that's why I think incest is now the dirty word. It used to be incest was the first word that could be spoken about. Then it was abuse as a general term. And I think the fear of love and love of abusing family is the unspeakable thing. And I made the mistake of talking to many patients about their abusers. Then how could they tell me they loved their mum and dad? And once I started saying, your family, then I could hear far more.
Any more comments or questions?
Thank you, Marsha Karp. You helped me understand something. I have a patient who was abused by father, and before the abuse, he would take her to a very posh Sunday lunch somewhere and kind of warm her up to the event. Consequently, as an adult woman, every time she goes to eat with a new young man, her anxiety in the restaurant is enormous because it's all going to happen again, or so it is. And I just want to share what you helped me understand is we did the scene of the restaurant, which is, she's now 50, so it's repeated for years, this sort of getting to know, put a scene for the father at the table and the new prospective man at the table. And she was able to tell the father to sort of fuck off and leave her alone, blah, blah, and then relate to the guy. So I said, what happened? Because she came and said she ate with the guy and she didn't hate him. I said, well, what happened? What was different? And she said, oh, I just visualized father sitting further away from the table so I could just be in the moment with this new guy. So she stopped. It was interesting, the split. So you helped me understand what was happening there.
Thank you. What a moving moment. And that's worth reminding us of Groundhog Days in some treatments, where when there's a tiny chink, and that's something Anne Alvarez, who I went to for supervision for years, was always wonderful at finding the tiny chink of a slight difference in the repetition and the hope that something would end up different this time.
Yeah, David Scharf, we really have to be grateful to Valerie and to Paul and Graham for bringing this problem back, which Fairbairn was very interested in, and he didn't really know what to do with, which he said. He said that remains for further investigation. But at the same time, this problem of multiplicity really did power so much of his own theorizing. One thing I think about it is that whenever we present cases like this, it villainizes these parents who are doing terrible things. But they themselves have always been traumatized. So that we want to go back to Fairbairn's paper on the psychology of the abuser in the 30s, that he understood the abusers themselves were victims of things. And that we have the intergenerational transmission. Sometimes the parents are actually bending over backwards not to be abusers, but the object relations of their abuse comes through anyway. It's a particular form of family tragedy. So I had a patient who spent his whole analysis looking for abuse, which he couldn't find, and he finally said late in the analysis, I have been looking for my parents' abuse. Very moving.
Yeah. Have we got any more comments, questions? If not, I'll thank... Oh, sorry, Helena.
I just wanted to say, Valerie, I really enjoyed listening to your clinical work, and you also put your head above the parapet. The thing we haven't talked to you about here is the changes in technique. You know, one stage I've always felt we're singing at the same mass and differing at theory. And, you know, it's that thing about education, There's all sorts of modifications in technique that follow from Fairbairn's. Be careful with the hostility. Do you know what I mean? Because you didn't meant it. The rage is also life.
Yeah.
You know, no.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for you for putting your head above the carpet, because I haven't.
If there are no further questions, then I'll just thank Eleanor, Carlos, and Valerie again. Thank you all very much.